You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, March 12th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone. So we'll point out a couple of famous birthdays this week, both on March 13th, one in 1855, Mr. Percival Lowell.
Percy.
We know him.
Yeah, he has an observatory named after him.
Lowell Observatory.
Predicted the existence of the planet Pluto and initiated the search.
And also the existence of canals on Mars.
Yes. So he's batting 500.
It's still better than me, so.
he's not alive anymore, by the way, folks. And the other folk who was born on March 13th, in 1733, Joseph Priestley.
Ah, Joe.
He's awesome.
Oh, from Beverly Hills 90210.
Exactly. Exactly.
He discovered oxygen, right?
That's exactly correct.
He didn't invent it? No, the stars do that, Jay.
That was right at the point where they were figuring out that there were elements, you know, that the world was made up of these different kinds of stuff, like oxygen.
Not earth, air, water, and fire.
Some of the other things Priestley discovered were sulfur dioxide, ammonia, nitrogen oxides, carbon monoxide, and silicon fluoride. Good man,
busy
Joseph
guy.
Priestley. Yeah, right? Would there be chemistry without him? Well.
There'd be alchemy. Well, we have an excellent interview coming up with Ken Miller later in the show. But first, we'll get to some news items. One of the big news items from the past week is that, as much anticipated, President Barack Obama has reversed the Bush administration ban on embryonic stem cell research.
Hooray.
That's awesome. To be more specific, President Bush banned federal funding for embryonic stem cell research, except for those embryonic stem cell lines that were established prior to the ban, so prior to August of 2001.
You guys remember that day?
Oh, absolutely.
I remember. We were so hopeful about that. Like, please, please, you know, do something unexpected. And, you know, he opened the door a tiny crack, but we were hoping that he would just kick it wide open. And then, of course, what was it? Less than a month later, 9/11 happened. And then nobody talked about stem cells for quite some time because, you know, we had
other stuff going on, yeah.
Yeah, I remember the question was, is he going to ban it outright and kowtow to the religious right, or is he going to, again, open it up for funding? And then he did the sort of middle thing, which was kind of looked at the time as a compromise, but really, you know, it didn't take long to figure out, well, the established lines, there's actually not as many as they said.
Right.
And they're not as useful as they thought. Banning the ability to create new embryonic stem cell lines was a huge negative impact on stem cell research. It did essentially stall embryonic stem cell research in the United States for 8 years.
It was a compromise, like teaching the controversy is a compromise. It's just not.
Right. Other countries went forward with it, though.
Yeah, like Korea.
Yeah, well, and now they're years ahead of
us. Like Liechtenstein.
The ban was significant, and the way it was enforced was actually pretty draconian. It made it so that a researcher and his institution couldn't accept any federal money if they were doing any embryonic stem cell research. So you really, if you were a university that depended on federal grants for research, for biological research, you couldn't touch embryonic stem cells except for those approved lines. So it really did make embryonic stem cell research toxic to anyone dependent upon federal funding, which, of course, was the purpose of it.
And now that Obama's fixed that, Harvard already, immediately following the announcement, they accepted their first undergraduate majoring in stem cell research, which is pretty exciting.
Wow. Did you guys know that it essentially started in the mid-90s with the Dickey Wicker Amendment, which I wasn't familiar with?
The
Dickey Wicker Amendment.
Okay. How could you not know?
Proceed.
Became law in 96, and it's been renewed by Congress every year since then, and it specifically bans the use of tax dollars to create human embryos or for research in any way in which if these embryos were destroyed or discarded or injured in any way. And then what Bush did, and which, as you can imagine, that prevent you, if you can't deal with the embryo, then you can't do any stem cell research. And what Bush did in 2001 was open the door just a tiny crack. And now what President Obama has done now is that he made it so that you could use any stem cell lines that you want, any embryos that have been created, especially the ones that are in these fertility clinics, that they're going to throw out anyway. He did not overturn this amendment. This amendment is still in force, and Obama is leaving it up to Congress, essentially, to make the decision, can researchers use federal money to create these embryos for use in research?
I think the current legislation is just about embryos that are being discarded, otherwise discarded. I could be wrong on this, but I think that they're going to need more legislation later on to determine whether or not researchers will be allowed to actually create embryos for stem cell research. But right now, it's just focused on those basically garbaged
I don't think
embryos.
Essentially, you're right, but I don't think it's necessarily the ones that are going to be discarded. I think they just have to be stem cell lines that were not created through federal funds. And if they're existing, they can use them whatever the provenance was. And it's going to be up to Congress. I think the president doesn't have the authority to overturn the DW amendment. And he specifically, the impression I get is that he explicitly is not saying anything about that, and he's leaving it up to Congress to take on that question.
But the bigger context here is the relationship between science in general and the government and the federal government. And we're looking to the Obama administration to see what signals they're sending in terms of how they're going to frame their relationship with science. The Bush administration had a terrible reputation in terms of its relationship with science on many issues, not just stem cells. The anticipation was that regardless of who won this election, but maybe perhaps specifically Obama, that they would be more respect for science. Here's a quote from him on this issue recently. He said, "Promoting science isn't just about providing resources. It's also about protecting free and open inquiry. It's about letting scientists like those who are here today do their jobs, free from manipulation or coercion, and listening to what they tell us, even when it's inconvenient, especially when it's inconvenient. It is about ensuring that scientific data is never distorted or concealed to serve a political agenda, and that we make scientific decisions based on facts, not ideology." So he is certainly talking the talk. I mean, that's definitely exactly what we would like to hear. Obama added a memorandum regarding science in general. And it's, again, essentially saying he wants to shield the scientific process from ideological intrusion. That is a very important, I think, signal to the scientific community. There's going to be a very different kind of relationship between the Obama administration and its scientific advisors and scientific institutions. Although I did point out when I blogged about this that so far he has had occasion to apply that principle to traditionally conservative points of view. I hope that he is just as dedicated to putting science above ideology when that ideology is liberal or something that his own party is in favor of. I trust it will be, but that still remains to be seen.
Something else that struck me in this whole issue, enmeshed in this whole announcement, Obama drew a strict line against human cloning. He said that his administration would never open the door to cloning for human reproduction. And he added that it's dangerous, profoundly wrong, and has no place in our society or any society. Can somebody tell me what the problem with cloning is? I mean, ideally, clones are just twins. They're not mutated, unnatural abominations. I don't understand the reaction to so many people.
The verbiage, Bob. It's clone has a negative connotation, I'd say, overall.
Right now, if you want to clone a dog, right now you have to clone like 100 mutant clones that you're throwing in the trash. So I think there's a big problem with it right now.
But that's pure technological issue. I mean, I'm talking like ideal clones. Just if cloning, and I think it eventually could easily become somewhat trivial in making a clone of somebody. Not needing to go through all these iterations of damaged embryos or all the problems. Yeah, right now it's at a very immature state. But I get the impression that regardless of the technology, just the idea, the concept of cloning. I mean, look at what Obama says here: dangerous, profoundly wrong, no place in our society or any society. To me, that he says that's just way over the top. I mean, it's just a clone. It's just a twin.
The way I was thinking of it was that with our current technology and with what we've got looking into the next, say, 8 years, that it's just not going to be at the point where it would be anywhere remotely humane to clone a human being. And even once you can do it with, you know, some amount of, you know, success, there's going to be some serious ethical considerations to bringing, you know, like to cloning a human being.
Well, that's what I don't get. Why are there any ethical considerations at all? If somebody wants to be cloned or allows himself to be cloned, what's the problem? It's a twin. Whether it's a twin is born 4 minutes apart or 40 years apart, it's still a twin. It's not some soulless creature that needs to be hunted down with pitchforks and torches. That's the impression I get.
Well, now I think that you are actually exaggerating. I think you're exaggerating what's being claimed.
Clearly, yes. I'm going for some of the fringe. I'm mocking some of the fringe comments that I've come across. But I have come across this reaction from people, this knee-jerk reaction to clones. I mean, that's not the common reaction, but there are people that have that reaction.
So the question is, are there those with legitimate ethical concerns about human cloning that understand the science and the technology, where it's not just because we're not technologically ready, but just they're against cloning in principle, and yet understand that it doesn't create some freak of nature, that it's just creating a sort of twin. In fact, somebody who's not even as identical as an actual twin would be. And that it's born as a baby, that it's basically a form of in vitro fertilization. It's not, again, you don't have a duplicate you that's an adult or anything like that.
Just off the top of my head, something that would concern me would be the ability of someone to clone themselves just in order to have a working organ factory, because that's the easiest way to, you know, be assured that when your liver stops working, you're going to have the perfect match because your clone is right there. But what you're talking about is not necessarily growing individual organs in a lab, but you've got an actual person there.
Yeah, but that's you have to clarify. You could say it's unethical to create a human being just as an organ farm. Sure, that's a perfectly legitimate point. But if you are using this technology to clone someone yourself, for example, in order just to have a child, for whatever reason you want to do that, that may be a bizarre personal choice, but
it's weird,
sure.
But
and there
not
may be unintended
unethical
consequences to consider, societal consequences. I'm not really sure that it's specifically unethical just to do that, though.
Well, and I'm not saying that it's outright unethical. All I'm saying is that there are legitimate concerns that, you know, people, I think it's an equally knee-jerk reaction to say that there's no problem with cloning and let's just go forward and try to clone a human. I think that, you know, at each step there should be certain questions answered. You know, why would we need this? What purpose will this solve? How will this be abused? Those are things that you just have to consider, I think.
Of course. Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm not arguing against that.
My sense is that Obama's rhetoric, though, was a little bit over the top and maybe was to soften the blow to his, you know, reversal of the stem cell ban by throwing a bone to the religious right.
And the quote I read, although it wasn't specifically in quotes, it did point out that it said cloning for human reproduction, which to me could be that's an out. It seems to me that's an out. I mean, cloning for human reproduction, clearly that's the most controversial aspect of it. But say cloning, say your liver, just your liver, using cloning technology for that, I think would be much less distasteful to people if it's not for reproduction. And hopefully we'll, you know, and that's one of the big benefits I'm hoping for cloning technology, not so that I can raise little Bobby Jr., but so that I could clone, say, you know, my liver if I'd ever need a new one, or kidneys,
yeah,
or whatever, any organs that I might need. And that's where this technology could lead, and that's what we're not going to have because of this reaction that so many people have, just knee-jerk, you know, reaction to cloning.
Well, you're a twin, Bob. You're all set, so you got Joe. And
well, unfortunately, I'm dizygotic twin, so just like regular brothers.
Right.
I will say briefly, though, that I think that, you know, your concern is warranted, but I, personally, I wouldn't be that concerned about it because about the public perception of human cloning, because what's going to happen is we're going to continue working on perfecting animal cloning. Decades will pass. Right. We'll finally be to the point where we can start working on human organs. And, you know, it'll go in those stages to the point where it's not going to be a big deal when you get to, you know, organs.
Well, let's move on and talk about chimpanzees and planning for the future.
From chimpanzee to chimpanzee.
Oh, the chimpanity. I'm sure you guys all heard about the chimp at the Swedish zoo. This is the Furuvik Zoo. They have a chimp there. And over years, they observed this chimp engaging in very interesting behavior. He liked to throw stones at human visitors to the zoo. And what they found him doing was actually stockpiling stones early in the day before the zoo opened to visitors. He was preparing a stockpile of stones that he could later use to throw at people when they made him agitated.
He was gathering his weapons of mass destruction.
He was. And he also learned how to pull off like little flat pieces of stone from the fake boulders that they have in his enclosure. He would work his way into the little cracks that form because of icing and then pull them off and again, store them up. There you go. We're all ready to go. And then when the people came out later, he would throw the stones at them.
Smart and violent.
Who is surprised by this? Like, does this sound strange in any way?
Well, the bit that's interesting is that this is the, to date, the most definitive evidence that a chimpanzee, a non-human, can anticipate a future state of mind and a future need and specifically prepare for it. So while he is calm and deliberating early in the day, he is stockpiling rocks that he will use later on when he becomes agitated at visitors staring at him or whatever. So he's actually anticipating this future need and future state. That has been controversial. There has certainly been observations in the wild, etc., that indicate that chimps do plan for future needs like this. But this is the most long-term and detailed observation because it's in a zoo and is pretty dramatic evidence that he was engaged in that very specific behavior.
So they think that he's calmly in the morning, you know, like, la, 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 I might be pissed off later today. Let me make a pile of stones.
Yes.
No, like he's pissed off all the time.
Well, how do they? But here's a question. Another possibility, perhaps. How do we know that he's not just say playing with the rocks, and it happens? The game happens to be to pile the rocks in the morning, and then goes off. He does his other monkey business during the course of the day. When the humans arrive, you know, there were the toys he was playing with earlier, and now I'm going to hurl my toys. So how are they? Sure that these two
events
are... Well,
from what I've read, he wasn't playing with the rocks. He was just collecting them and stockpiling.
But how do we know that's not a game to the chimpanzee?
Well, wasn't he drawing faces of people on the rocks, too?
He was. He was carving them.
Also consider, Evan...
Making flint points, yeah.
You know how fun it would be to be able to throw rocks at people and have, like, no consequences? Of course it's fun.
Fun?
The guy wants to do it.
What's his name, Cornelius?
Hey, wait a second. A chimpanzee throwing a rock, that would hurt.
They are so strong.
And the thing is,
I would think he could kill you with a rock.
I guarantee you, if they had video of it, like he throws the rock, and if he ever gets anyone, he's got to like laugh or do something, like make an expression on his face.
Apparently, they've been studying this chimpanzee since 1997. So. They've been keeping a close eye on him and his behavioral patterns, so I imagine they have enough data there to draw this conclusion.
Well, they
like
are.
I said,
yeah,
they're about 90% sure that this is what's going on.
They actually do think that Santino, that's his name, was anticipating a future mood that he was going to be in.
Right.
So, you know, I was joking before, but they actually do think, you know, he's calmly picking up weapons, you know, picking up rocks and stuff and preparing for, like, him not being so happy later on, which is really interesting to me because, like, I don't even do that. Like, what am I, you know?
Well, you know what's funny is I happen to be reading a book right now called Stumbling on Happiness by Harvard psychologist Daniel Gilbert. And it's a very amusing book, and he opens it by saying that every psychologist in his lifetime has to write a book that begins with the words, "Humans are the only animal that can." And he's always resisted, but has finally decided to take his chance, because what happens is every time someone writes a book like that, within a few years, they discover chimpanzees doing whatever it is that humans are the only animal that can do. So he chose, humans are the only animal that can foresee the future and think about the future.
Wrong.
And he said he was fairly certain that that one was going to stand solid.
Oh my God.
So I'm going to send him an email and see if I can make
but
him
Evan,
cry.
Evan raises a very good point, that we are always inferring what's going on in an animal's head when they display behavior like this. This seems like a pretty reasonable interpretation, though, that he was not just playing and said, oh, I have this stockpile of rocks, let me throw it at these people. That he was actually using the stockpile specifically to have ammunition to throw at people. But yes, we can only infer. We can't get inside their head and know exactly what they're thinking. But if that interpretation is accurate, that means that chimpanzees have a form of consciousness. They are conscious.
Of course.
In a way that is very, you know, similar to, in some degree, or has some features that are in
but
common
Steve,
with humans.
There you go again. Well, like, who's surprised by that? Like, why?
Well, that one isn't very surprising, because we have tons of evidence to suggest that dozens of animals have what, you know, could be called
and
consciousness.
There are things that chimp could throw that are much worse than those rocks, too. Keep that in mind.
Yeah, right. I'm not surprised, but you know, we don't want to make assumptions. It's good to have evidence to say that this is specifically true.
I thought of another example of an animal doing things for the purpose of future events, and you know, a squirrel who gathers its nuts and puts them away is anticipating the cold winter coming in.
Well, here we go. So with something like that, the problem is we don't know that they're actually conscious that they're going to need the acorns in the future. They're actually thinking about the future versus it's just a behavior.
Yeah,
it's just an instinctive behavior. You know, they're just doing what they do and not necessarily knowing why they're doing it. Something like that, like saving up acorns and then eating them over the winter, is a routine behavior, so that it's easy to see how that would evolve to be instinctive. Whereas this was a novel behavior. It'd be hard to argue that chimpanzees evolved to stockpile stones, you know.
Right.
So this is something that's novel. So it's not something that you could argue is just a rote instinctive behavior.
And the squirrel example was also used in the book I'm reading. He gave the same explanation, that it's out of, you know, instinct. But it suddenly occurred to me, with that in mind, how cool must it be for you to be a squirrel and it's getting cold and there's no food left and you're thinking, man, I'm hungry. Oh, that's right.
Yes.
Oh, man, I can't believe I did that.
Or maybe they're just like, hey, here's an acorn. Where'd that come from? All right, I guess I'll eat this acorn.
They must just think they're the luckiest bastards on the planet.
I always
That's
thought it,
never
was,
see
it seemed really kind of comfy and stuff. Like, they have like this huge pile of food. They have like this warm little hole, you know, like pile of leaves and stuff. And they just hang out all winter and reach over.
Yeah, reach over, grab their nuts, and they're good.
That's you know, it's a good life. Life of a squirrel.
Yeah, you have dogs to deal with, though, because dogs hate squirrels.
Dogs eat squirrels, don't they?
They never catch them.
Yeah, that's true.
Squirrels are kind of jerks, no, which is probably, you know, it makes sense now. They're so, you know, they're so happy. And
that's right.
Well, you're right. They are very Disney-esque.
They might as well be jerks to everybody else.
The worst thing about squirrels is that they voraciously steal food from bird feeders, and it's almost impossible to keep them away from the bird feeders. In fact, the only thing that succeeded in my situation was getting a dog to keep the squirrels away.
Now, have you seen the squirrel-a-pult on YouTube?
It's
hilarious. They set up this crazy thing where they waited for the squirrel to come get the bird feed, and it just... I don't know how exactly they did it. Some springs and
that squirrel does
maybe
everything.
It just flung the squirrel.
Like, he literally, like, pole vaults over molten lava. Like, the squirrel gets through anything that they put in front of it.
Literally, huh?
And you're telling me that's not a planning for some kind of future event? I think we're underestimating the brain of a squirrel.
Well, there's some problem solving that's going on. That's not the same thing as planning for the future. Birds do a lot of problem solving, too.
Oh, yeah.
We're getting a little off topic here, though.
Especially, like, crows. Crows are scary mofos.
The whole Jay family, yeah, absolutely.
Hey, Jay.
Well,
and,
yeah.
You know, I think we do have to mention, though, because we have a monkey article, and this is, you know, chalk one up in the column for monkeys.
Chimps.
Against the...
Chimps.
Chalk one I'm going to re-say it. Chalk
for the non-human primates.
Chalk one up for the non-human primates under the win column for this one, as opposed to the birds.
Just today, or yesterday, actually, there was a news story about a monkey with a cruel owner, and apparently he was forced to climb palm trees by his owner, and he killed the guy with a coconut.
Oh, boy. He threw it right down on his head.
Uh-huh. On
monkey
his head.
Monkey justice. Ooh.
Don't F with the monkey, man.
PZ thinks it's the beginning of the uprising. Going to overthrow their human masters.
Now, did he mention the Connecticut incident of the chimpanzee that mauled the woman?
No, he didn't. Yeah, the woman owned a chimpanzee, kept it more like a replacement husband than a pet.
The chimp did an awful thing to that woman. I mean, I don't know if she deserved it or not, but it ripped...
Not her, not the chimp's owner, but the chimp's owner's
friend. It ripped the lady's face off, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And her hands.
Yeah.
And I've read many times, like, they're really cute when they're young and everything, and then, you know, they have a serious personality and attitude change as they get older, so they're not very good pets.
Yeah, it's because it's a wild animal, you know.
Surprise. Actually, in the article about the coconut killing, the best line is, the dead man's wife said that the monkey had seemed lovable when they bought him for 130 pounds.
We have two quick news items about various kinds of snake oil, but we'll cover these quickly.
Snake oil? Like titanoboa oil?
Right, exactly. Although snake oil would be preferable to this next item, which they're calling mellow yellow.
If you have a weak stomach, fast forward about 5 minutes. There's a hardline Hindu organization called the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh. Let's just call them the RSS. Okay.
You didn't butcher that at all, Jay. That was perfect.
They started processing a new soft drink that's actually made from cow's urine.
So that's their big plan. They don't say, Western food is bad, so have this cow pee instead.
They call it Mountain Moo.
So they're doing laboratory testing on it now over the next couple of months. They didn't give a commercial release date. And, you know, there are other details that we don't know. Like, we don't actually know if they're going to flavor it, like give it an actual flavor, or if it's going to kind of taste like urine mixed with the berries that they're going to mix in. Like, they're going to mix it with aloe vera and gooseberry. And the idea with the gooseberry is that that's going to fight diseases. And here's a pretty weird thing about it. The head of the RSS Cow Protection Department said, and I'm quoting him, cow urine offers a cure for around 70 to 80 incurable diseases like diabetes. All are curable by cow urine.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Oh, boy.
Yep.
Yeah, so that's a long-term belief in Indian folk culture, the idea of drinking urine, one's own urine, or in this case cow urine, as a tonic to treat illness. So not surprising, actually, but trying to go mass market with cow pee, that's something.
Well, you know, it probably will do sales in India, but they actually said, that same guy said, it's, you know, they're selling it nationwide in markets and everything, but they're also not ruling out international success. And I don't know any other country that would go for that.
I'm telling you, rule it out.
I mean, you got to have some real marketing whizzes dealing
with
it.
Oh,
heaven, that
was, nice
that
one.
That was good, man.
Was that even intentional?
That's just a stream of consciousness.
Oh.
And then in England, they're having their own snake oil brouhaha. Did you know that Prince Charles has his own snake oil company called Duchy Originals?
Yep.
You had me sold at Prince Charles as soon as you said it.
he is marketing a detox tincture. So Duchy Originals detox tincture. I mean, that could be written on the side of a carny trailer with a Barker out.
Yeah, right.
I mean, think about that.
Old Charlie's
old-fashioned. What do you say, Steve? Oh, God.
So just capitalizing on the whole detox fad. The BBC ran an article about this, and they quoted Edzard Ernst, who was the co-author of Trick or Treatment, Alternative Medicine Trial, and he said, "Nothing would, of course, be easier than to demonstrate that detox products work. All one needed to do was to take a few blood samples from volunteers and test whether this or that toxin is eliminated from the body faster than normal. But where are the studies that demonstrate efficacy? They do not exist, and the reason is simple. These products have no real detoxification effects. They are bunk."
So, Steve, is he selling multiple products, like different forms? Like, is it a liquid? Is it a pill? Is it a salve?
I think it's just this one tincture, right, which is a liquid, I'm assuming.
Like, and you drink it, or you put it on the outside? Like, is it for topical use?
No, that would be a salve.
Okay, so this is a drink.
Yeah. I think so, yes.
It's an elixir.
Elixir, yes.
Care for an old nip of the bubbly, Governor?
Dr. Phineas's magic elixir.
Right, it's terrible. Mean, it,
really, it is something out of, you know, Lemony Snicket or something. I mean,
good movie.
God.
It was a good movie.
Right. I think that the word tincture may specifically imply that there's some alcohol in there.
Oh, even better.
Even better.
An old active nip of the bubbly, Governor.
That's called an active ingredient.
Yeah. Right, that's the active ingredient.
So this is not a soft drink.
Well, let's go on to our interview. Joining us now is Kenneth Miller. Ken, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And Ken Miller is a professor of biology and the Royce Family Professor for Teaching Excellence at Brown University. He's also the author of several books, including a biology textbook from Prentice Hall, as well as two books for the public, Finding Darwin's God and Only a Theory. So, Ken, you've been on the front lines, very actively involved in not only promoting the public understanding of science and evolution in particular, but also combating the creationists and intelligent design proponents who are on a mission to oppose public understanding of evolution. So tell us how you got involved with that fight.
Well, I'm tempted to say how much time you got, because it's a fairly long story, but I'll cut to the chase very quickly. In my very first year of teaching at Brown University, which was 1981, a group of undergraduate students came to me, and they challenged me to debate a scientific creationist whose name was Henry Morris. And I did not know at the time, but Henry Morris is really sort of the godfather of the scientific creationist movement in the United States. He was the founder of the Institute for Creation Research in California, and he was also the co-author of a really, really important book for young Earth creationists called Genesis Flood. And this is a book that basically argues that the biblical record of natural history, Earth is 6,000 years old, all geological formations formed basically in the flood of Noah and stuff like that, is scientifically correct. And almost without knowing what I was getting into, I knew a little bit, I agreed to debate this guy. Fortunately, I had the good sense to ask from the students for maybe a couple of his articles and books and an audio tape of the debate that he had had before and so forth. And when I heard these things, I was, first of all, terrified, because this guy was raising all sorts of arguments that I didn't know how to answer at the time. And the second thing was I was outraged. And the first thing that irritated me were the distortions and the misleading interpretations of science, and that bothered me a lot as a scientist. The second thing was the way in which he used religion. And what I mean by that is he and other scientific creationists would make the argument that we ought to allow a religious interpretation of natural history into the science classroom because it's just as good as science. Morris, in fact, was fond of saying that creation is every bit as scientific as evolution, and evolution is every bit as religious as creation. That was one of the ways in which he tried to argue equivalence. But one of the things that immediately was apparent to me, and I'm not sure it would be apparent to someone who is a strict secularist, is the kind of religion that Morris wanted in the science classroom wasn't just, you know, like generic belief in God religion. It was a very particular kind, a very specific brand of fundamentalist Protestantism. And as a Catholic, I immediately thought, wait a minute, this is not how I think about God. And that's what really got my dander up, because what the First Amendment protects all of us against is not just the state promoting religion, but especially the state promoting one particular religious denomination over any others. And basically that got me into it. And then the other thing that told me how important this debate was, and I really didn't expect this, is we ended up having this debate, because of the number of tickets that they sold, in the largest room on our campus. That turns out to be the hockey rink. And it drew, and I'm not making this up, about 3,000 people to Wow. listen to this debate in April of 1981. And that's the moment when I realized, man, this is an issue that people feel very, very passionately about. And I realized at that point that a scientist who was willing to take the time to look at their arguments one by one and then very, very carefully explain why they were wrong, explain what the other side was trying to do and so forth, could not only be effective against them, but also could perform a really important public service. So that's essentially how I got into this.
So how did you do in that debate?
I beat him hands down. And the reason for this is simply I spent literally 5 weeks preparing. I had no teaching in the particular semester I debated him. So I spent 5 weeks literally researching every one of his arguments and making up a whole set, almost 150, of 35-millimeter slides to anticipate every argument and show what the real answer was. And the reason there are two reasons I know I won the debate. The first thing is at the end of the debate, the science writer and the religion writer for the Providence Journal, the local newspaper in Providence, Rhode Island, came up to me, and they told me that they had a bet on the debate. They had bet each other dinner. And the science writer had bet on Morris. And the reason for that is because he said the creationists always win these debates. Mm-hmm. And the religion writer, just to be a gentleman, had bet on me. And the religion writer came up to me with a big grin on his face and said, "You won me dinner." The other thing is that Morris himself, in his own institution's publication, which is a monthly newsletter called Acts and Facts, actually wrote that, I think these are his exact words, "Miller was the most effective evolutionist debater I have encountered to date." And a lot of people recognize that as coded language for that he couldn't make any inroads, and I was able to show his distortions and the right. other problems. And you know, for a while in the early 1980s, I actually acquired a reputation for debating creationists. Now, I only did it four times, twice against Morris and twice against a fellow named Dwayne Gish,
mm-hmm.
who was known at the time and probably a lot of people still think of as their most formidable debater.
Gish Gallup.
Right.
And the other thing I should tell you is that 1983, and many of your listeners may know this, there was a major court case on the teaching of so-called creation science in the schools. And the reason there was such a case was because two states, Louisiana and Arkansas, actually passed laws requiring high schools to teach creation science. The first lawsuit against those laws came into federal court in Arkansas. It was called McLean versus Board of Education. It was a very big, highly publicized trial. Stephen Jay Gould testified in it and so forth. And it was a complete victory for evolution. And at that point, I decided the good guys had won. I'm going to retire from this. I'm going to go back to the laboratory and keep doing the cell biology work that I do. But what drew me back into this is in the late 1980s, I was talked into doing something outrageous by a former student of mine, and that was sitting down with him and writing together a high school biology textbook. That great guy's name was Joe Levine. We flipped a coin. Joe lost the coin flip, so this book was called Biology by Miller and Levine. And to our absolute amazement, in the early 1990s, it became an almost overnight bestseller in the high school textbook market. And what that meant, first of all, is we got a lot of books out there. Mrs. Miller was very happy. But it also meant that as often as not in any school district, when people complained that their textbooks contained too much evolution or there was too much of an emphasis on evolution, it was our book they were complaining about.
Right.
So that drew me back into the controversy, you might say, almost as a matter of self-defense, because I had to defend my work.
Right, and I remember you wrote about the fact that in, I believe it was in Cobb County in Georgia, when there was the controversy over putting the stickers inside the biology textbook warning that evolution was only a theory. That was your textbook they were putting the stickers into.
Well, yeah, it certainly was our textbook, but it actually, to be fair, it was every life science textbook at any grade level that even mentioned evolution. So there were middle school life science textbooks. There were actually middle school earth science books, because earth science very often deals with evolution, geological ages, and so forth. They got the sticker, too, and so did Neil Campbell's advanced placement book in biology as well. But our book certainly got the stickers. I was actually, coincidentally, at Georgia Tech early in 2004, just giving a scientific seminar, and a fellow came up to me, and he identified himself as Jeff Selman and explained that he was the lead plaintiff in a lawsuit to get these stickers out. And he said, if we actually get the trial on this, would you be willing to fly out here to Atlanta and testify on the trial? And I said, sure. That trial took place in November 2004. I did testify on the first day of the trial. It lasted about a week. And the case resulted in victory for Jeff. He's a very courageous guy. Mm-hmm. And the other plaintiffs, and those stickers are now out of the textbooks in Cobb County, Georgia.
Getting back to the debate issue very quickly, I've actually been very impressed with you. I've seen you in a lot of venues, and you consistently are, in my opinion, the most prepared guy on the science or the evolution side, and that fits with what you're telling us, how much time you spent prepping. Like, for example, you were on Firing Line, I recall, and you always seem to have the perfect example at your fingertips. And there's a lot of belief within those of us who are promoting evolution and trying to counteract creationists and intelligent design proponents, that it's kind of folly to debate them because the debate format or venue is unfairly advantageous to those who are distorting science or creating misconceptions. As Bob mentioned, the Gish Gallop, it's hard to deal with. But I felt like those people like you who were prepared enough could still eke out a victory.
Well, here's the way I'd respond to that. First of all, I agree with your general premise, mm-hmm. and that is you don't go around debating these guys anywhere, anytime, any place, because what that does, I mean, the whole format of a debate about anything is an impression of equivalence, because you're both standing up there, you're both saying things back and forth, and anyone can look at it and say, well, there's two sides to this argument. Mm-hmm. So I think one has to be very careful about accepting invitations to debate. But let me give you an example that relates to what you just said. You said you saw me on the Firing Line debate. This was held in December, 1997, a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And what had become apparent leading up to that is that William F. Buckley, the host of Firing Line, someone with whose political views I completely disagree, but whom I always respected intellectually, that Buckley had started to produce programs that were very favorable to this new strand of creationism called intelligent design, and that he was determined to go ahead and have a Firing Line debate in which he and three other people took the intelligent design position against evolutionists on the other side. And when I was invited to participate in that, I realized two things. One is these guys had this platform, whether I agreed to participate or not. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing was that I think that we in the scientific community make a terrible mistake if we simply say we're not going to answer these guys and we leave the public square vacant for them to monopolize. So it's not a question of constantly running around saying I'll debate any bozo that's out there, but it is a question of strategically picking your spots and saying, you know what, there are certain times when you have to stand up and you say, here are the five arguments you just raised, let me show you how easily they're answered by the facts, by authentic scientific evidence. And that's what I and the other people actually on our team, and the other people on our team were Barry Lynn from Americans United for Separation of Church and State, Jeannie Scott from the great Jeannie Scott, yep. I would say, from the National Center for Science Education, and also the philosopher of science, Michael Ruse. And Michael had played a critical role as the philosopher who testified way back in 1983 in that McLean versus Board of Education case in Arkansas. And I think we really quite convincingly carried the day in that debate. And actually, our success in that debate actually befuddled William F. Buckley, because when the debate was over, he actually wrote me and he said, can you explain to me why we lost this debate so thoroughly and why it was that David Berlinski, who had debated me one-on-one, did so poorly? And I tried to explain to him,
he's wrong.
That we really did have an unfair advantage. And if you were just debating on points, You know, it was just terrible. It was an unfair situation. The reason for that was, quite frankly, we had the facts on our side. And that's something about science, as opposed to literary criticism, artistic theory, political science. What science really does is to show that certain ideas are wrong. And I don't think Buckley, not being a scientist, fully appreciated that.
Ken, do you think that your own religious views impact your ability to connect and to convey a message to creationists?
I think it probably does to some people. If you go back, however, and look at that firing line debate, I don't think I said a word about religion the whole time. I tried to focus in on the scientific issues. I think it does matter to some people that, for example, I am a professing Roman Catholic. So they figure, although you got to remember that in some fundamentalist circles, being a Catholic is even worse than being an atheist.
Right.
For lots of, you know, I have been told to my face that I'm not a Christian because no Catholics are Christians. But you know, when
Jack Chick has written a lot of mean pamphlets about you.
Oh yeah. Oh, well, he's, Jack Chick is an equal opportunity hater. He's written a lot of mean pamphlets about everybody. but you know, that's quite shocking the first time it happens. But at this point, I've gotten used to it. So I think to some extent that's true. But when I talk to fellow Christians, I don't say, for example, believe me because I'm a Christian just like you. And when I mislead you, Lord knows the history of the United States and the history of the world is filled with people who profess to be Christians and misled people about everything from Enron to the Iraq War. But the point that I try to tell them is if you're sincere about your faith, the first duty of any Christian is to the truth. And you should be just as curious as any secular scientist, as any philosophical materialist, about the nature of life, the origin of life, and the relationships between species. And if you're honest in that curiosity, it's going to lead you to evolution, regardless of what you think about the ultimate questions of religious faith.
And in that same vein, I'm wondering how you feel about the recent issue with the Pope admitting that, yes, there is such a thing as evolution and that whole kerfuffle. Do you have an opinion on what the Pope thinks of evolution?
Well, I'm tempted to say, don't get me started on the present Pope. but I think actually, to be fair to Pope Benedict, he didn't just admit this, but he actually came out quite strongly in favor of it. And in fact, in a brief press conference with a group of Italian journalists in 2007, he said that the evolution versus creation controversy, and this is his word, is an absurdity, because there are many scientific tests in favor of evolution, which appears to be a truth which we must acknowledge. Now, that was a pretty straightforward statement. And the interesting thing is that it follows an even stronger statement by his predecessor, Pope John Paul II, in 1996, in a letter that he wrote to the Pontifical Academy of Sciences. And people who haven't followed the position of the Catholic Church on this might be surprised that the very first pope to speak in any sense on the issue of evolution was Pius XII. And in 1947, this is 62 years ago, he wrote in an encyclical that the theory of evolution is perfectly compatible with Christianity. Or the way he actually put it was to say that evolution does not necessarily contradict the teachings of the Church. So the way that I look at the Church, and I could be pretty cynical about this, is they're kind of embarrassed about the whole Galileo thing.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, they want to get over it. And you may remember one of the first things that John Paul II did when he became Pope was to convene a little committee to review and then to exonerate Galileo.
Right.
Now, don't get me wrong. I don't think Galileo cares anymore. But the reality is that what he was really trying to do was to send a signal to the scientific community that we don't want to be your enemy anymore. And I think John Paul II sent that signal very, very well. The present pope, I think, in a somewhat less skillful way, is actually trying to do the same thing.
But my interpretation of Pope Benedict's recent statement was not that he felt the need to make a scientific statement about the legitimacy of evolution, but rather he was making a philosophical statement about the nature of Catholicism.
Oh, I think you're right.
He's saying that the Catholic Church does not have a problem with the findings of science. And I think that obviously, I think that that's a direction that all the major world religions should go in, because it's all, I think, long-term, a losing strategy to have a fight with science.
What choice do you have?
Yeah, no, I think that's the first step.
Along those lines, I think that you have been instrumental in sort of promoting the same idea, specifically in finding Darwin's God. I thought you were extremely eloquent in writing about, you know, the kind of God that you believe in is one in which Darwin can believe in, because it's one in which that creates a universe that allows for things like evolution to happen. Can you expound on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, and actually, you know, I'll expound on it by pointing out that the particular position I took when I wrote that book, which came out almost 10 years ago, is actually a very traditional one from Christian theology. And it's traditional in the sense that it sort of mimics what Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century wrote about nature and God. And Aquinas' idea was really very simple. And that is, just because you show that a particular phenomenon has a natural explanation, whether it's the rising and setting of the sun and the moon, or the movements of the tide, or Aquinas didn't say this, but I am now, or, for that matter, the origin of species. Just because you say that, that doesn't take God out of the picture. And the reason for that, and this is according to Aquinas, is because God is the author of all things natural. So therefore, when you show that something is a natural phenomenon, all that that does is to show that it is within God's providential sphere as the author of all things natural. So that's why ultimately this very materialistic discipline, which we call science, is, I think, ultimately compatible with faith. Now, I have to warn you here, when I say compatible with faith, I am not making a claim that faith or any particular religion is scientifically provable. That's not the statement I'm trying to make. The statement I am trying to make is that there are ways in which people of faith who are already convinced of the reality of God can understand science and, I think, accommodate themselves to it within their own religious views.
So how do we promote? I mean, I feel to some extent a little helpless, because I understand that, you know, in the United States, for example, the problem with the public acceptance of evolution is mainly coming from what's being preached from the pulpit. And that doesn't seem to be something that I, as like a science educator, can affect. I do think that because you straddle both worlds, you may be in a better position to do that. But just how does the scientific community deal with this problem that is ultimately one of theology?
Well, I have to say I disagree with you a little bit there in terms of, is it just one of theology? I mean, there were several surveys that basically looked at things like religious faith, level of education, political party affiliation, and so forth. For example, registered Democrats are a whole lot more likely to accept the theory of evolution than registered Republicans are. But the strongest correlation in several of these surveys is simply level of education. And even for someone who identifies themselves as being from the fundamentalist tradition, with every level of education, completed eighth grade, high school, college, graduate degree, and so forth, at every level you step up, the acceptance of evolution becomes greater. So I really think that this is a problem that ultimately is solved by education, and I think it's solved by effective science education. And I don't think we have to turn ourselves inside out to say this idea is compatible with religion and therefore it's okay for you to believe it. What I do think we have to do much better is we have to explain why the idea is correct. Mm-hmm. To me, that's what matters. So it's not a question of taking evolution, watering it down, and sort of presenting it in an acceptable way to Christians or to fundamentalist Christians. I think the real key here is simply better science teaching. And there are two things. No one would argue that we do a great job of science education in the United States, not just with evolution, but anything else in science, physics, chemistry, mathematics, you name it. We really have to realize something, that this country learned, however briefly, in the 1950s and 1960s, which is that our future is built on effective education in science and technology. That's something that we learned very quickly in the Sputnik era, when we were competing with the Soviet Union, and scientists of my generation, guys now in their 50s and early 60s, we were in school at the time, and we were the beneficiaries of that enthusiasm for science education. I'd like to see this country get just as scared about its primacy in world science leadership as we were then, because I think it would have a beneficial effect. But the other thing on this particular issue is I think that we in the scientific community, and I'm indicting myself as well when I say this, I think we suck at popularizing science. We simply don't see it as the job description of most working scientists and educators to go out in the public, to answer questions, to make things clear to the average layperson. And that absence from the public square creates a vacuum. And quite frankly, the creationists and the intelligent design guys, they're only too eager to rush in and fill that vacuum. And part of it is because there's almost like a sociological aversion to someone who is good at popularizing science.
But I do think that we may be moving into a new era with the new media, with blogs and podcasts, et cetera, where I think more scientists are feeling comfortable getting out into popularizing science because it's a little bit easier to do it on a blog, for example. I also think that that may be a better medium for addressing these issues, and that reminds me of a recently you specifically and directly took on Casey Luskin from the Discovery Institute as a guest blogger on The Loom.
Right.
I thought that that worked out very well. You were able to utterly devastate him in three blog posts in a very detailed way that you couldn't really do in a live debate, for example.
Oh, I think you bring up a good point. And first of all, I hope all of your listeners know about The Loom, which is a wonderful blog that's hosted by Carl Zimmer. Mm-hmm. And Carl's a friend of mine, and when I saw that Casey Luskin, who is sort of the paid public spokesman for the Discovery Institute, had decided that 3 years after the Dover trial, he would try to impeach some of my testimony in that trial by saying where I had got things wrong. And what he was really trying to do was to spin a new line on their defeat in the Dover trial. And, you know, I told Carl, I said, boy, I got to write something about this. He says, why don't you put it on my blog? And I think you are right that there are many things about the new media, blogging being one of those new media, that really are ideally suited for scientific communications. And as you know, there are a lot of scientists now who do indeed have their own blogs and are able to command fairly large audiences. And I think that's a plus.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, like reading your takedown of Casey Luskin and just dealing with them ourselves, I just can't, you know, help but to constantly feel about the guys who are writing for the Discovery Institute. I think that they are so intellectually dishonest and disingenuous and I can't escape that conclusion whenever I read what they write, which I do more often than I probably should for my own sanity. What do you think about that? I mean, how can, first of all, do you agree with that assessment, and how can we make that more plain to the public that really these are intellectual scoundrels?
Well, I try really hard not to look too deeply into the motivations of people that I strongly disagree with, in part because when someone raises a series of points that I think are bogus, like Mr. Luskin did earlier this year, I think the least effective way to get back at them is an ad hominem attack in which you say you're intellectually dishonest, you're lying, and so forth. I think the most effective way is to say, okay, let's see what Mr. Luskin said. Here's point number one, here's point number two. Here's why point number one is incorrect. Here's how I'd answer point number two, and so forth. Because what you then don't degenerate into is a whole bunch of name-calling. And what you do show people is, quite frankly, that the evidence and the facts are on your side. So I may secretly harbor some of the same sentiments that you just expressed about people who work and write for the Discovery Institute, but I don't think that expressing those views are the most effective way to combat them. I think the most effective way is with the facts.
Now, obviously, you're right, and that's exactly what we do, what I do. I mean, I've parlayed with some of the guys at the Discovery Institute before, like Dr. Egnor, and that's the...
Oh my goodness, I admire your patience.
Yeah, that's exactly... You patiently take them down point by point by point, and, you know, my goal is for my readers to come to the conclusion that the guy's intellectually dishonest just based upon his behavior, but I don't shy away from pointing out the fact that, in addition to their point by point takedown, yeah, these guys are pretty intellectually dishonest, and they tip their hand many, many times.
Yep, I agree.
But your point is obviously well taken. Do you have any projects you're working on for the future?
Well, my co-author, Joe Levine, and I have just finished about a year and a half of working on a new high school biology textbook. Our textbooks are usually used at the 9th or 10th grade level, and this book is going to come out in the next month or so for use in classrooms this September. It has even more of an evolutionary focus than we've written into our textbooks before. We've also completely revised in light with current research. We've completely revised the way in which organisms are classified, that kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species type things, to be in line with modern evolutionary classification. And therefore, this is going to be a book that even more so uses evolution as the central organizing principle in biology. So we're very proud of this work, and this book is going to come out very shortly. And I know I'll be going into wonderful states, states I like Texas. I'm not kidding about that, to market this book and to talk to teachers, and I look forward to that. I'm also in the process of working on a third trade book, a book that will follow only a theory, basically about the biology of human nature. And more than that, I just really can't quite say at this time because I haven't finished it enough to be able to tell you how it will differ and how it will be similar to other books. But that'll be my next trade book, and that I hope to have done within a year or 18 months.
Is that going to be about evolutionary psychology?
To some extent. To some extent, it'll be about evolutionary psychology. It will also be about the marks genetically and physiologically of our kinship with other animals, and the role that evolution has played in shaping human psychology.
And about your textbook, you said you're going to change the classification system. Are you talking about cladistics? About
that? Yes, exactly. I didn't want to use a jargon term.
Okay.
But the cladistics clearly is the basis for biological classification. We've used it in the scientific profession for the better part of a decade and a half. I think it's about time that it should find its way into the secondary school classroom, and Joe and I decided simply we wanted to be the leaders in doing that for the very first time. So that's how our new book is going to be organized.
So is that a tweak of the Linnaean classification system, but it's still using the same basic nomenclature, or is it really completely different when you go over
It really is completely different because, you know, at this point, what I would call traditional classification uses a six-kingdom system, in which we have two kingdoms of prokaryotic organisms, the bacteria and the archaea, and then we have four eukaryotic kingdoms, protists, fungi, animals, and plants. Well, you know, as you know, if you followed biology closely on this point, there is a greater diversity within the protists, the organisms we used to just call protozoa. There's greater diversity in there than there is in any of the other kingdoms. And actually, when you look at what we know about sequence comparisons now from DNA, it turns out that humans and fungi, in other words, you and the yeast that helped your bread to rise, are in fact much more closely related to each other than two different protists are on either side of that kingdom. So all the diversity of animals, plants, and fungi is actually one little branch coming up of what we used to call protists. So the old idea of distinct kingdoms really has faded into the background. And what we now talk about are six major clades of eukaryotic organisms coming out, and animals and fungi split off just one of those six major clades, and plants split off after another. So we're still going to use the words kingdom, phylum, class, and so forth, but we're going to make it clear to students that these words are traditional. They don't really fit what we understand right now scientifically, and if you really want to understand life the way it is, the cladistic approach is going to be the best.
Awesome. Well, Ken, thank you so much for all the work that you do, and thank you so much for being on the Skeptics Guide. We really enjoyed having you.
It was my pleasure. I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. The theme is batteries. So we're all news items about batteries.
And assault.
And pepper.
Here we go. Number one. Item number one. MIT researchers have created a new process for manufacturing lithium-ion batteries that allow them to be charged and discharged much faster. A large battery can be fully charged in minutes rather than hours.
Wow.
Item number two, physicists have created a new type of battery that uses magnetic spin rather than chemical bonds to store energy. And item number three, Texas company eStore has produced and will market this year an ultra-capacitor-based energy storage system that has 10 times the energy density as current lithium-ion batteries. Bob, go first.
Okay. The new MIT process for lithium-ion for charging and discharging. Yeah, I could see that in minutes. We seem to be approaching that in the news items that I've been looking at over the past bunch of months. So that it's not a big surprise there. Nice advance, though. Way to go, MIT, if that is true. The second one about using batteries, using spin to store energy, that's pretty interesting. As cool as that is and as an amazing advance as that is, I still think that the ultra-capacitor, which is number three, is not ready for prime time. I hope we can do it. I just don't think we're quite there yet. And so I'm going to have to say that one is fiction.
All right, Jay.
A large battery can be fully charged in minutes rather than hours. That's awesome. God, I hope that's true. Second one, physicists have created a new type of battery that uses magnetic spin rather than chemical bonds to store energy. Magnetic spin. And number three, Texas company, eStore. It's weird that he used the company name, and the ultra-capacitor thing just seems silly to me as well. All right, so I'm going to say the first one is not fake. The stupid magnetic spin thing. I don't know about that, Steve. I'll go with the second one as the fake. The magnetic spin, yes.
The magnetic spin. Okay, Rebecca?
So I know nothing about batteries, to the point where just the other day I was complaining about the light on my bike helmet and how it would go out every time I knocked it around a little bit. And someone suggested that I change the battery. And it's been doing this for like months. It's very dangerous. And it never actually...
Wait. Rebecca, you ride a bike around a major city in the United States. And you actually wear a helmet that has a light on it.
Well, yeah.
Like, does the helmet also go, woo, 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 woo? Or like...
No, but it's got a propeller on top.
Whatever. None of it stopped me from getting hit today. So I guess it's not really worth it anyway.
So you're saying, Rebecca, that you'll wear a helmet with a light on it. You'll place functionality over fashion.
Oh, no, I look super cute in the helmet.
I mean, you look like someone who wears a cell phone on their belt.
No. This is a rad helmet, okay? It's my roller derby helmet. It's got radioactive stickers on either side of it, and it's
so if
really
I put
cool.
a radioactive sticker on my cell phone, then you'd be cool with it on my hip.
No.
Well, Steve, but if it had a little siren that went,
it would be lame.
Woo, then it would be cool. Rebecca...
Rebecca. Can't have it both ways now.
You guys are hopeless. You don't even understand. My point was simply to say that I know nothing about batteries, except for I know that a battery using magnetic spin rather than chemical bonds is really cool. And so I think that's true. So it's between the first one and the third one. And honestly, I don't know. I'm skeptical of the use of the company name eStore, and also the idea that they've produced and are marketing this thing this year. That seems awful fast for something I've never heard of. So I'm gonna side with Bob and say that eStore is full of crap.
Okay, Evan.
Well,
come on, Evan.
The MIT researcher, so that one, fully charged in minutes rather than hours. Seems improbable, right? But it is the correct next step of technology as far as that aspect of batteries go. So that's entirely plausible, and I think that one's science. I think the physicist creating the battery using magnetic spin, I think that is also science. It's probably a pretty big battery, maybe. I mean, something, you know, that sits in a corner of a room, not some little thing you put in your laptop, computer, or cell phone yet. But yeah, sure, the concept, I think. Therefore, all that's left is that Texas company. Yeehaw. That one's fiction.
Mm. Yeehaw.
Okay, so you all agree that MIT researchers have developed a new way of manufacturing a lithium-ion battery that allows it to be charged much faster. A large battery can be charged fully in minutes rather than hours. You all agree that that one is science. And that
sounds
one
like it to me.
Is science.
Yay.
Yeah, but when are we going to see it? That's the question.
Yeah, that's always the question. But because this is, you know, an incremental step using, you know, existing materials, and it's really just a new process, it may not take long to scale this up to any kind of mass production. So researchers have known for a while that the lithium batteries can store a lot of energy, but their real limitation is that the energy can only move so quickly. The electrons, the current, can only move so quickly. This means they take a long time to recharge, and also it means you can only derive so much power out of them. So for use, for example, in cars, in either hybrid cars or in all-electric cars, they get reasonable range. Still, I don't think ready for prime time, but, you know, reasonable range. But you can't get that much power out of them, so you need something else, like a motor, for example, to get enough energy for quick acceleration. What the MIT researchers found is that the electrons moving through the different layers in the battery get slowed because they have to move through these little pores, specifically lithium, nickel, manganese oxide. The crystalline structure was very disordered. This, you know, caused these roadblocks for the lithium ions and slowing down both the charge and discharge rate. But they worked out a manufacturing process that makes it much more orderly, a much more ordered crystalline structure, allowing the lithium ions to flow much more freely between the metal layers. Now, I've read different reports about how much this would actually speed up the battery. Some reports say it would make it 10 times faster than the unmodified lithium nickel manganese oxide batteries. Some say that it could recharge a battery in seconds, although I think they're talking about very small batteries, or a larger battery in minutes, the kind of battery that would currently take hours. So larger meaning, for example, a battery for your laptop, a computer, could be recharged fully in a few minutes rather than taking longer to recharge it. Of course.
Wow.
Let's go on to number two. Physicists have created a new type of battery that uses magnetic spin rather than chemical bonds to store energy. Everyone thinks that one is real except for Jay, who thinks it's a fake. And that one is also science.
Oh, I mean, really?
Yeah, really.
Could I be doing that bad?
Apparently.
Yes.
This year? Like, really?
Yeah. Having a bad run, Jay. You really are.
This was a tough one.
Have you gotten one right this year, Jay?
This is super cool.
I don't remember getting anything right this year.
So a battery is basically a device that stores energy. And ideally, you like it to have characteristics where it's easy and quick to put a charge into it, to put energy into it, and then it will store that charge for a long time without any degradation. It can release the energy on demand very quickly, and then you can go through many cycles of recharging and discharge without degrading the battery itself or losing its capacity. Right now, most batteries that we're using are chemical batteries. They store the energy in chemical bonds, in ions, and then the chemical reaction releases those ions, and that's what generates the current. What this does, this is a completely new approach, a so-called spin battery that charges the battery by applying an external magnetic field. And what this does is it spins up these little nano magnets inside. Mm-hmm. And it was likened to like winding up a toy, where, you know, you're winding up some kind of spring-loaded device. You're spinning up these nano batteries in such a way, in these nanomagnets, such a way that they store energy, and then that energy can be later released. It's actually more directly storing electricity in this way, and then directly releasing it rather than having to convert it to chemical energy.
That is awesome.
I think if this is the kind of thing that pans out technologically in terms of, you know, being able to scale up and be manufactured, this could be a significant revolution. I mean, this could have a lot greater energy density, be able to go through many more charge-discharge cycles. Very cool. I tried to delve as deep as I could to try to understand exactly how the energy was being stored, but none of the articles I could find went into a lot of detail, which means that Texas company eStore has produced and will market this year an ultracapacitor-based energy storage system that has 10 times the energy density as current lithium-ion batteries is fiction.
Of course, that was the only one left.
Of course, the company eStore really exists, and they have been promising this ultracapacitor-based energy storage system for a number of years now, a few years. Yeah, and it never comes to fruition.
I actually, Google alerted me to EE store and ultracapacitor, those two words, and every day I got an alert from Google about some story mentioning those two words together, and every one I looked at was pure fluff.
Yes.
It was like no evidence, no real evidence that they actually had an ultracapacitor that could do the work, and all these companies were like giving them money and all this stuff. Even I think the military might have got involved for a while, but still all fluff.
But they still don't have a product. There's still tremendous skepticism within the industry. Experts who have evaluated their technology say they don't have anything to show us. You know, they don't. And here's the limiting. So the ultracapacitors are a neat idea where you have, you know, plates that hold the charge, you know, physically apart from each other. And ultracapacitors, or at least, you know, capacitors exist. And their strength is that they could very rapidly take a charge and discharge it. And of course, they could do this with endless cycles without degradation. But the limiting factor is that they can only hold so much energy. So the thinking is that maybe they would be useful to store a little bit of electrical energy, like, for example, for an electric car, and it could release it very quickly in order to produce acceleration when you need it. But then you have a more traditional battery for range. But now this e-store company is claiming that they've been able to, you know, break through that limitation. However, the problem is that at the extremely high voltages that would be necessary, there is current leakage. And you also get micro fractures from temperature changes. And they haven't demonstrated that they've solved these problems. So this one remains, you know, interesting, but still fiction as of right now.
Hey, Evan.
Yo.
Do you hear something?
Who's that noisy? Who's that noisy? Who's that noisy?
Yeah.
Evan.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Can you play the Who's That Noisy from last week?
Who's that noisy?
Here we go.
News from Charles. Before everything is over, I'll tell you, he's going to be completely delivered because of your prayers, because of your faith. Here it comes, complete healing in Jesus. Ooh, mighty name, right now, right now, right now. Amen. It's all right to praise the Lord. Right now, right now.
So there you go. And...
And that was...
I hate that guy.
The one and only runner-up for douchebag of the universe, Peter Popoff.
Peter Popoff. Loser.
Scam artist, swindler, con artist, cheat.
Totally revealed by Randy. And it was probably one of my, if not my absolute favorite Randy reveal. He totally pulled the mask off of this guy. Yeah, give us a good one tonight, Evan.
Here is this week's Who's That Noisy? Get ready.
That's a...
No guesses. No. What we need for this one, folks, is we need to know exactly what made that noise, all right?
Okay.
No generalizations. I want specifics.
Okay,
so a bit more challenging than the Peter Popoff one from last week.
Right.
So, good luck, everyone.
Good job, Evan. Jay, give us a quote this week.
I found a really cool quote by someone that I had never heard of before. His name is Anaxagoras, and he was a pre-Socratic Greek philosopher famous for introducing the cosmological concept of nous, which means mind, and he lived 500 BC to 428 BC, and he said, "Everything has a natural explanation. The moon is not a god, but a great rock, and the sun a hot rock." Anaxagoras!
Well, thank you all for joining me again this week.
Jointly.
Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.